You hear plenty of talk about how our county imprisons more people than any other. You also hear plenty of talk about abuse and degradation of our environment. Our next guests focus on both of those issues simultaneously. They are connected to the Prison Ecology Project, an effort to make prisons cleaner places, both for the people inside the walls and for the people living outside and downstream. The Prison Ecology Project is a creation of the Human Rights Defense Council. Paul Wright, is the Human Rights Defense Council Executive Director and Founder. And Panagioti Tsolkas is the HRDC Special Projects Coordinator. Panagioti, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, great to be here.
Paul Wright, thank you for joining us. Appreciate you having you along as well.
Thank you. We're glad to be on the show. And it's the Human Rights Defense Center.
Okay.
No problem.
So appreciate that. So the prison ecology is one issue of many. I mean, how big a constellation overall of prison issues, Paul?
Well, it's pretty huge. And I think one of the first things that we have to start out with, I think a lot of times people don't think of environmental issues as involving people that are incarcerated or people that are in prison. But when you think about the prison nation in this country of 2.5 million people, it's literally a city the size of Houston if everyone was in one place or were held in one place. And what we've seen is in the last 30 years or so, the United States has built around 1,500 prisons, and a lot of those prisons were built in places that weren't that great to begin with. This includes abandoned uranium mines, EPA Superfund sites, abandoned military bases that had undergone years, if not decades, of toxic waste dumping, literal toxic waste dumps, and plenty of other places that just weren't that desirable from anyone's perspective, and they built prisons and jails on them. So I think that's one of the things we're trying to bring some attention to and focus on, just in terms of what it means to incarcerate people, hold them against their will, in these dangerous, toxic environments, above and beyond whatever the actual conditions of confinement are.
Well, I was going to ask you if the conditions of confinement obscured some of the environmental issues in the sense that people were thinking about, let's deal with the day-to-day conditions, not what they're living in. So did the environmental issues often get pushed to a secondary position?
I don't know that they're necessarily pushed to a secondary position. I think it just wasn't really anything that was considered a lot at the time by anyone other than some of the prisoner rights advocates. And I think there's also kind of this mentality or this view that basically once the prison is built, it's a done deal. Once the government spends $200 million building a prison complex, no one is really going to do anything about the fact that it's built on an abandoned uranium mine. Ironically, I think this is one of those things that just because the government doesn't take an interest in the environment doesn't necessarily mean that the environment doesn't take an interest in the government, because we've seen some examples where prisons were built on abandoned coal mines in Ohio and Pennsylvania, and then the mines started to sink and collapse, and the prison on top of them did as well, resulting in the prisons being abandoned. So that's kind of an extreme case where the issue kind of didn't go away. But I think when you look at a lot of these places, I think the overall mentality is that, you know, once the prison is built, we're kind of stuck with it and nothing's going to change that, regardless of the health conditions or what's happening with the prisons. We've seen prisons in California, for example. The Kern County, there's a prison in Kern County, California, has extremely high levels of arsenic in the water. And so far, the prison is trundling along, and the prisoners are having to drink arsenic-laden water, and no one's doing anything about it.
This reminds me of Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison commenting on the stuff in the glasses that looks like tea.
Right, yeah, exactly. And in some respects, that was, 30, 40 years ago?
Right.
But in some respects, things haven't really changed a lot. We've seen some of the stuff in California as well, where prisons have been built, for example, where they're subject to valley fever, which occurs naturally in the land, but I would say that it was probably a foreseeable thing that if you're going to build a bunch of prisons in an area prone to that type of soil-borne disease, maybe this isn't a really good idea to build a prison. But the state of California went ahead. They built the prisons there anyways. Dozens of prisoners and staff members have died as a result of valley fever, and the prisons are still there. So it's almost like one of those build it and they will come mentality, but also this once it's built, it's not going away either mentality.
Panagiotis Tsoukas, are some environmental issues unique to prisons, though? Are there some things that happen inside of prison walls that we don't know about that don't happen elsewhere?
Yeah, for certain. Well, I think going back to the Johnny Cash reference, what he says is that the water tastes like it run off of Luther's boots, and I think the reality is a lot worse than drinking someone's sweaty boot. It's like Paul mentioned with the chemicals, the arsenic, and things that wouldn't end up in water supplies in other cases are ending up a disturbingly regular basis in prisons and jails. And I think one of the stark examples of the recent years was a chemical spill in West Virginia that a lot of people heard about almost immediately. The area surrounding the chemical spill was put on water supply that was not contaminated, bottled water, et cetera. They brought relief in, but it took weeks to get the same relief into the regional jail facility there, the South Central Jail outside of Charleston, West Virginia.
Weeks, not days?
Weeks. And I think even months later, there still wasn't confirmation as to whether or not the water that they were receiving was being tested at the same level, the same standard as people outside the jail.
Not subject to the same rigor. Okay, let's come back and talk more about what's going on inside prisons and the effects of prison ecology on communities outside the prison walls as well. Panagiotis Tsoukas and Paul Ryder with the Human Rights Defense Center will come back and talk more about the Prison Ecology Project when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about the Prison Ecology Project with a couple of people involved in its founding and its execution. Paul Wright is the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's a former inmate himself and the editor of Prison Legal News. Panagiotis Tsoukas is the special projects coordinator for the HRDC. He coordinates community outreach and volunteers. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about environmental issues inside prison walls or affecting the people in prisons and the effects that then can radiate outside the prison walls as well. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join the conversation by phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. So, Panagiotis, in the example you gave about the contamination of the water supply because of a chemical spill into a major river in West Virginia, this is not the kind of thing that people can claim after weeks that they didn't know about, because people in other parts of the country knew, oh, my God, these people can't drink their own water.
Right. Well, the only conclusion that I think you'd be led to after looking at dozens of examples, for example, we gathered up a dozen examples to submit in a recent EPA comment, and that was just really kind of skimming the surface of similar situations of people being subjected to contamination, pollution, hazardous waste, EPA Superfund sites. And the only explanation that would make any sense is that these people are viewed as less than human or having less rights to public health and quality of water, which is just not the case. Legally, socially, it does appear to be the case, but what we're trying to understand and trying to explore is how the government is justifying it. The state and federal government has all the examples are coming from facilities all the way up from the local county level to federal government, BOP facilities, Homeland Security, and immigrant detention facilities. So what is it? Why is it that these people are not being given the same environmental protections? Even though the laws around what's called the environmental justice movement, they date back all the way to the Civil Rights era, the Civil Rights Act 1964. It has a provision that people are not supposed to be discriminated on based on, their income, on their race. And one of the cases we're making is that we know that prisons disproportionately incarcerate people based on income and race. And so... And that technical, legal aspect, why aren't people in jails and prisons being considered, equally valued for protection as people outside of jails and prisons?
So you got a couple of different approaches you're obviously making here in the outreach end of things. You're trying to let the people who live outside prison walls know that this exists and can affect them. You're trying to let them know that it can affect the people on the inside, but you're also trying to let the people who run the prisons know. And it seems like that's been the brick wall you've run into a bunch of times.
Right.
Well, I wouldn't say it's necessarily a brick wall. I'd say it's more the policies of exclusion. And these are deliberate government policies. I mean, this stuff isn't just happening. I mean, people in government are making deliberate, considered choices to build prisons on toxic waste dumps, keep them operating, keep them functioning, filling them up with people that are held there literally at gunpoint. So, I mean, it's not like this is an accident where, gosh, how did we spend $200 million building a prison complex and it just showed up there? But no, these are very conscious decisions. And I think one of the things is that we've also got there's kind of like two sides to the prison environmental coin. On the one hand, we've got the one that we've been talking about where the prisons are being built on toxic waste dumps and the prisoners are themselves subjected and the staff are subjected to contamination because of where the prison is located. Then the flip side of it is we have the prison itself as the source of toxic waste contamination. And in California, for example, you have dozens of prisons around the state that are dumping millions of gallons of raw untreated sewage into the waters around the prisons and around the facilities. You have prisons around the country that are dumping toxic waste. They're themselves the sources of toxic waste that poison the surrounding communities. So there's kind of like a different, it's almost the same indifference to the environment and to environmental issues that I think leads to both. On the one hand, the government that doesn't care about building prisons on toxic waste sites, regardless of the health consequences to the people living and working inside these prisons. And then the flip side is when they run these prisons, they don't really care if the prison itself then becomes a toxic waste polluter in its own right.
Panagiotis Sokas and Paul Wright are our guests on the Jefferson Exchange from the Human Rights Defense Center. We're talking about the Prison Ecology Project. You can join us at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Paul, you've mentioned, 1,500 prisons built in 30 years, and do you have any idea of the percentage built on things like the abandoned uranium mines or the Superfund sites?
No, that's one of the things that we're trying to get a better grasp on or a better handle on, and we do know that a lot of these were built, but it's just almost kind of incidental to our reporting. We've been around since 1990. We've reported on a lot of prison construction as it was happening, and a lot of this stuff was pointed out by activists at the time who were opposing prison construction in the first place, and then also prison location, prison siting as a secondary matter as well. And we just know that a lot of these facilities were built on places that had environmental issues to begin with. The BOP, the Federal Bureau of Prisons flagship facility in Florence, Colorado, for example, that's where the federal government's ADX Supermax prison is located. That's built on an abandoned uranium mine. We report on a number of prisons in Pennsylvania and Ohio that have been built on abandoned coal mines. And in some cases, they've been built either on top of or adjacent to dumping grounds for coal ash. Rikers Island Jail in New York City, for example, is literally built on top of a landfill in the middle of the Hudson River, and to the point that the facility routinely has methane gas explosions that rock the facility. So we have a lot of knowledge that hasn't really been pieced together yet, and that's part of one of the things that the Prison Ecology Project hopes to do is kind of bring it together and just start getting a handle on how many facilities are there nationally that are built on these toxic waste sites, as well as how many of these facilities are violating state and federal laws in terms of their own toxic waste emissions.
It can certainly be tricky getting information from the federal government. I guess that's just generally acknowledged. But have you had any greater success getting state prisons or county lockups to deliver information about what goes on inside there or their environmental effects if they're dumping sewage, things like that?
Well, I think it kind of depends. Some places are better than others. For example, the state of Washington, we've done some big stories over the years about ongoing about ongoing toxic waste emissions from prisons in Washington State. The Department of Ecology has been very helpful in terms of getting this information out that other places aren't so helpful. The California Department of Ecology is not exactly a model of transparency. The federal EPA, they're kind of more middle of the road. But I think it kind of depends. In general, I think one of the big problems that we have with our criminal justice system is it's probably the least transparent of all systems of government in this country. When you start getting into other agencies, the amount of cooperation or transparency that you get kind of varies. But I think one of the things that happens is when you're asking one government agency for negative information about basically another government agency, they're not as helpful as, say, for example, we were asking what's going on with the local private company that's polluting the environment or whatever. They definitely seem to be a little more reluctant to be helpful than if we were asking about private companies or non-government entities.
Paul Wright and Panagiotis Tsoulkas, again, our guests on the Jefferson Exchange from the Human Rights Defense Center. We're talking about the Prison Ecology Project, and you can join in. 800-838-3760 to reach us by phone on the Jefferson Exchange. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We've talked primarily about the government lockups. Then now, what with the rise of privately run prisons and jails, are things about the same with those, worse, better, any different really?
Not really. It's pretty much about the same thing. I think that a lot of what drives, what has driven a lot of the building of prisons on toxic waste sites is literally cheap land. And the reason it's cheap is because, well, it's toxic and contaminated, and no one wants to build anything on there. So I think to an extent it kind of has been a lot of the same forces driving it. Also drive it with the private prison industry as well. That said, because the private prison industry is newer, it only came into existence in its modern form in 1983, their facilities tend to be newer, and there's also fewer of them. So I think that's one of the things that impacts the numbers, is just newer and fewer, but overall there's still a lot of the same issues.
I would say a few things that would be maybe distinguished with private prisons are that maybe because they're newer, they're using some of the greenwashing language and getting, say, LEED certifications for,
for building practices
or the water treatment systems. And so we've been looking at that. You know, what does it actually look like when a prison gets a LEED certification and calls itself a green building? Well, you know, prisons are inherently water and energy hogs. So, you know, putting some extra insulation or, you know, a couple solar panels or catching some rainwater off the roof really pales in comparison to, sewage coming from thousands of people locked up. And the example, I think, in Washington State really is one of the most stark, because this is one of the first prisons to get LEED certification for the actual facility, not just the administrative building, but the actual prison facility.
Really? The actual lockup area itself was LEED certified?
It was LEED certified, and the same year it became LEED certified, it also got busted for dumping sewage into the Skykomish River, and for 10 years following that. Now, we just surfaced this story last year and published a big report about it, but for 10 years of its LEED certification, it was also dumping enormous amounts of sewage into the Skykomish River, which leads into the Puget Sound, impacting potentially millions of people and their water supply and their recreation, the waterways that use for fishing and boating and, wildlife recreation. So, and really the example that makes it stand out so much, what Paul just said happened exactly, where the State Department of Ecology said, we see problems here, what's going on, and the internal documents that we were able to surface through our public records request, showed that the emails, explicit emails saying, hey, we don't think it looks so good for your government agency to be looking at our government agency, and can we just work this out somehow, can we just keep this, kind of keep it to ourselves? And I'm inclined to say that's not the only time that ever happened. I think it's pretty standard in those sort of instances for a government agency to be kind of hamstrung or silenced by the bureaucracy of, the higher level political people who don't want to see, who don't want to be exposed for what they're allowing with these overcrowded prisons.
Well, Panagiotti, there's also some mention on the website about trying to get information about inspections at federal prisons. There are schedules for inspections of, particularly at the federal system, right? And what have you been able to find out about whether they're happening, and if so, how often?
Yeah, this was actually one of the things that really motivated the project, was that Region 3 of the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, this is a Mid-Atlantic region, they had what they called their prison initiative, and they really broke a lot of ground showing that prisons were consistently chronic violators of broad-spectrum regulation problems, ranging from hazardous waste management, from spill control and air and water pollution, a lot of it coming from the factories that prisons operate, or a lot of times prisons run their own power plants for energy or their own water treatment plants for waste and sewage. So they were documenting pretty much every prison they went into came out as a violator of environmental regulations, from the local, local Philly jail all the way up to the federal prison in Virginia where they did inspections. And they, for 10 years, they did a steady round of inspections. And then all of a sudden in 2011, it sort of faded. And so last year we asked them what happened. Why did they end this seemingly successful initiative? And they hemmed and hawed and didn't really have a clear explanation except for maybe the obvious one, the lack of resources to continue it. And then soon after our inquiry about that program, they pulled all history of it off the website. So you can no longer find the EPA's prison initiative if you search, the Region 3 website. You can dig around and find some of the press releases that came out initially, but aside from our website at prisonecology.org, the history of that successful effort has kind of been erased. So now we have this new quest to try to get it back on, back on track and push other EPA regions and maybe, the overarching federal agency to take on a prison initiative similar to what Region 3 did and build off of it.
We're talking about prison ecology and the Prison Ecology Project with Panagiotti Tsolkas and Paul Wright at the Human Rights Defense Center. Paul, there have been lawsuits filed, including against an Alabama prison, I see. Over what and what kinds of results have there been so far?
Some of the lawsuits that have been filed have been around the dumping of raw sewage into waterways. And there's been, given the scope of the problem, the amount of litigation that has actually resulted has been very small in comparison to, I think the scope of the problem. And I think in the Alabama case, that one ultimately resulted in a court order they clean up that they stopped discharging sewage into the rivers and clean it up. But part of the problem, though, is that it took 10 years. And for a lot of these issues, though, once the prison is built, it's kind of like there's not really a lot of interest or enthusiasm by the courts to issue or order relief. And I think, we've seen this in California where the prisons have been built in the Central Valley where prisoners are subjected to valley fever. Mm-hmm. The courts have issued in existing conditions cases, the Plata versus Brown medical conditions case, the court has issued orders that prisoners who are most susceptible to valley fever be removed from the prisons, which I think has been around 3,000 or 4,000 prisoners have been relocated elsewhere. But then the problem with that is, what about all the prisoners that were left behind and, of course, the staff? I mean, and I think that's one of those things, too, is that it's in some respects, it's we focus a lot of our attention on what's happening to the prisoners in these toxic facilities. But, it's not a complete discussion without noting the staff as well.
Because lots of other human beings inside, yeah.
Right, because they're being exposed to it as well. And in some respects, you can say, well, the prisoners have to live there 24/7. But then on the other hand, the staff are working there for 20 or 30 years, then that's kind of a long-term toxic exposure as well. And And in some respects, I think that, you know, because of the way our country is, the prisoners are viewed as an expendable population and the staff not necessarily as expendable. Ultimately, they may, in terms of forcing anything about the issue changing, it may be through workplace safety issues that we see that change happen rather than as a prisoner rights issue. Ironically enough.
Clearly lots of work ahead for the Prison Ecology Project. Paul Wright is the executive director and founder of the Human Rights Defense Center in Panagiotis-Olkos, the special projects coordinator there. I want to thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having us.
Sure. Take care.